Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Our next guest is Steve Westner. I'm particularly anxious to hear from him because I have on my desk his book, Profitable Podcasting. Now, Steve offers a very unusual way of helping small businesses generate income. Steve, welcome to the program, and outline us a little bit about your background and what your company does and to help small business.
Well, thanks, Don, very much for that. And gentlemen, thank you for the invitation to be here with you and in your audience. I'm grateful for that. And so thank you. And just as a brief overview, my book, as you mentioned, Profitable Podcasting, really is, in essence, the entire recipe of some of the work that we do at my core business, which is called Predictive ROI. So when I wrote the book, I wanted to make sure that included everything. And some people have said to me, why on earth would you want to do that? And I thought, why on earth would I not want to do that? And so what Predictive ROI does is we help a business owner get really, really clear about what they stand for. We call that the flag, sort of the purpose or their point of view within their business. And then we help them create cornerstone content or the thought leadership that cements that flag into the place of, you know, audience. We give them a stage to be able to share that point of view with other people. Their audience grows, and then we show them how to monetize, not necessarily the audience, but how they can use them, that platform, that stage, to drive revenue into their core business. So that's what Predictive ROI does. And then the book, Profitable Podcasting, really breaks down the entire recipe for how we do that.
Well, your website, Steve?
Our website is predictiveroi.com, which also provides a detailed overview as to the various components that we provide clients. But yep, so it's predictiveroi.com, and that's where your listeners can also find our podcast, my daily podcast for business owners called Onward Nation.
Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Dan in 1 minute, but if I understand you correctly, you help a small business create a podcast that in effect helps them broadcast what they do and how they do it better. Am I hearing that correctly?
You are hearing that correctly, and then we take it a step further by also turning that marketing channel into not a cost like traditional marketing, but instead it becomes a profit center. So the time and expense that is invested in building that channel then also drives revenue back into the business so that it becomes a self-funded, platform after a period of time. Hence the name Predictive ROI. We like to be able to predict a client's return on investment before we ever start.
So, in effect, you use direct marketing and other tools to better sell a podcast broadcaster's goods and services. Am I right?
We don't use direct mail or some of the more kind of traditional media. Although that is not to say that isn't of value. That's just not where our expertise is. And so what we really focus on is helping a client get really, really clear about their point of view, and then creating weekly content and thought leadership. We call that cornerstone content, so that, you know, a particular episode turns into 50 different pieces of smaller content. So to their audience, you know, our client is just always there trying to be helpful and providing, you know, great resources and so forth. And then that relationship with the audience grows, and then the monetization model kicks in. So there are, you know, significant revenue opportunities on behalf of our client.
I'm going to turn it over to Dan now.
Okay.
Thank you. Steve, I've been fascinated with podcasting and the streaming whole side of the communication structure. We have seen our audience just explode in terms of downloading to almost approaching 700,000 page views or views a month. But it seems to me that one of the things that is happening, and most recently with the acquisition by Disney of pieces of 20th Century Fox, is that the value of content is accelerating dramatically. And I guess the question I want to ask you is, what is the importance of content, or is it overstated?
No, I don't think it's overstated at all. In fact, if I could be so bold to say that it's just now being stated correctly, in fact, maybe even still a little bit understated, meaning that, you know, in today's world, one of the things that, you know, when I sat down to interview Gary Vaynerchuk for episode 42 of Onward Nation, one of the things he said to me, and I believe this to the core, is that if you're not out talking, then you're not talking. And while everyone else is, your audience then is going to shrink or be non-existent and not know about the amazing, awesome, wonderful, incredible, and beautiful things that you're capable of and how you can then be helpful and build an audience around that. That's the power of content, good content. And so when a thought leader truly approaches his or her audience about not, you know, how do I monetize the audience, but how I can truly be helpful, the money comes later, and it's a byproduct of really being a true thought leader and being helpful. So I think that content is essentially the ante. It gets you, you know, a seat at the table, and it is like essentially a prerequisite. And, you know, when you're going out to talk with a new client or prospective client, that person is looking at you on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and your LinkedIn, and do you have a podcast, and how many ratings and reviews do you have, and does that person have a book? And in today's world of, you know, selling expertise, if you don't have those components, I think you lose.
So given I read on Drudge this morning that based on last weekend's box office, Disney had 93% of the revenue across all of their various platforms and their various production companies. So they're becoming a major force and they believe that content is king. And so if I'm a small business person and I want to think about you and your company, and I've never done any podcasts, I don't have any experience on radio or TV, what can you do for him, and what should he or she expect from you?
Well, okay, so kind of a two-part question there. Let me set, this might sound a little bit silly, but let me set me aside for a second and go to the content piece and how Disney is dominating right now. And because really that's at the core, and that is the strategy, right? And so it's less about the tactical execution and first with the strategy. So I would encourage your listeners, as the very first step, go to Google and search on this would be the search string, Walt Disney's business plan image. So Walt Disney's business plan image, and you will find the business plan that Walt Disney himself drew back in 1957. And you will see how back, you know, 50 plus years ago, 60 years ago, how content was always at the cornerstone of that company. And it will show you the visualization, the dotted lines from, you know, films out to magazines, out to TV shows, out to publishing, out to amusement parks or the theme parks and so forth. This is 1957. And so I would encourage your listeners to go and do that Google search, Walt Disney's business plan image, find that image, and then think strategically about how I could take this content map that Walt Disney created and how could I apply a similar thing to my business, and how could content drive the revenue in our business just as Walt Disney does. And then as far as, you know, us or another provider, then start once the strategy is mapped, then start thinking about tactical executions and who might be the right partner. Maybe do it in-house, maybe find several partners, whether it's predictive ROI or others, in order to help you move that pace and tempo of execution according to the plan that is aligned with your overall goal.
And then we come back to you, which we set aside.
Yeah, oh, so exactly. So then, like, how we might be able to help in that is then we help clients get really clear on what that plan is. I just don't want to feel like I'm, like, you know, pitching predictive ROI. So thank you for giving me the time and space to do that and share a little bit more about it. But once we get really, really clear on what the client wants to accomplish, sort of this visual map, if you will, then we build, okay, what is our point of view? What is the purpose, the mission of the business? Like, how can we build a platform around that is going to be then helpful? And then we can break that down into, you know, a 7-phase production model that consists of 20 different steps, you know, so that we're putting out brand new content every single day on behalf of that client. So again, whether it's predictive ROI or, you know, your business 1, 2, 3 that you choose as a partner, just make sure that you choose a partner that can move at the pace and tempo that creates the quality of content that delivers to your vision.
I'd like to jump in here because I'm getting a little confused. So, I get confused easily, but I produce a specialized pasta to help people reduce their weight.
Okay.
I would come to you and I'd say to you, I want to create a podcast that will help me sell my product. You would then find that. What would be the next steps?
Okay, so first we'd have, you know, pretty fundamental, right? First we'd have a pretty in-depth conversation about the product itself and why is it going to be helpful. Then we'd talk about, you know, how building an audience around whatever that positioning, how does that help? Is that going to drive distribution into retail locations where you already may have distribution? Or are you going to try to build an audience so that then you can roll out to distributors in, you know, food distribution and food service and say, look, you need to carry our product. You need to get it on the shelves because of this audience. They're looking for it and they can't find it. So we need to think about a B2C play, but then we also need to think about a B2B play. And my guess is that's going to be a combination of both. You're going to want to be very, very helpful with your quote unquote audience in providing recipes and tips. You're probably going to want to interview, you know, other complementary thought leaders, whether that's, you know, dietitians, nutritionists, workout, fitness experts, so that you build a show around, you know, your core things in your flag, whether that's weight loss, healthy living, you know, lifestyle and so forth. You build a show around that and build an audience around that. And then your core product, you mentioned pasta, that pasta then becomes the sponsor of that show. And then on the B2B side, your sales team is going out and working with distributors and saying, look, we've got a top-rated show on iTunes. We're moving that out to YouTube. We've got a great Facebook presence. And look at the quotes on Instagram and the comments on Instagram, excuse me, and look at all this interaction. That's why you need to carry our product. And so that's where the audience can also then help you on the B2B side. But I don't envision that you would be selling boxes of pasta, you know, during your podcast episodes. That feels like kind of a miss to me. I think it's about being helpful to your audience and then being sure to use that as leverage on the B2B side.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book. Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. How is your vision? I'm not talking about your eyesight, but rather can you see the changes coming in your business or industry? The ability to see what's coming can give you an edge over your competition. Industry magazines can be a great help to see changes coming to your business. You get the magazines because you belong to a group. Use the resource of your group or association to keep yourself current. You're paying for it anyway, why not use this resource? If you keep yourself abreast of what's happening, you will be able to make the changes to enhance your opportunity to grow your business. So here's your Recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. The next time you get one of those membership magazines in the mail, sit down and read it cover to cover. You just might uncover a new opportunity. I'm Dan Perkins from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day.
Dan, back to you.
Thank you. So let's play the vision game. Where do you see podcasting going over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think podcasting is really hot right now, but as a technology, it's been around since 1996, 97. I think it's really hot right now because finally distribution has caught up to it. The smartphone has caught up to it, and it made, quite frankly, the audio more accessible, right? I mean, streaming audio over the internet has been around for, quite a few years. It's just now It's easier to consume. Ever since Apple with, I think it was iOS 8, eight, that made the podcast app native on the iPhone. And then it made it so much easier to consume podcasts. So my point with that is that, in chapter one of my book, I cite several great, statistics from Edison Research about how we really are, even though there's this huge momentum around audio, we're really at the tip of the iceberg. We are literally just starting to scratch the surface with respect to distribution. Now that Amazon Echo is a point of distribution for podcasts should tell us something. The fact that I can stand in my kitchen and say, Alexa, play Onward Nation, or ask any pod to play Onward Nation episode 623, and Alexa will queue up episode 623 and play it for me while I'm standing in the kitchen. The fact that Spotify is now in the podcast space. The fact that there are, a bunch of offshoot apps, that are carrying, like Overcast and others, they're carrying distribution of podcasts and becoming huge favorites because they're really playing to the likes and dislikes of their audiences, really shows us that long-form audio is really just at the tip of the iceberg. And if you're a great storyteller with a great vision and point of view and being helpful for your audience, you're going to win over the long term.
So what happens to the traditional communication structure of the radio station as we know it, the AM or FM radio station? What happens to that technology? Does it disappear?
Well, I don't know that it necessarily disappears, but and this is an area that I don't have expertise as far as terrestrial radio and the future of that. So I'm speaking a little bit out of turn. But I think what we're going to continue to see is, from a media spend perspective, we're going to continue to see shifting dollars, online in support of other medium. And I think that what consumers are saying, in voting with their attention is that they, you know, want less ads and they want to be able to have a more custom experience, niche topics right at their fingertips. And so if I'm running a media company today and it's been traditionally in the traditional space, then I'm going to want to be crafting niche shows and that, you know, so that we can go super, super deep into a particular, it might be a smaller audience, but it might be a more loyal audience. I'm going to really pay attention to the personalities of the people who are on my shows, and I'm going to get them out into YouTube and Instagram and so forth so that we're not relying on one channel of distribution, that we're really looking at how we can build personality and brand around what it is that we do, as opposed to being, you know, an AFM station that plays, you know, such and such a music format, you know, from this time to this time, and the rest of the time it's, you know, whatever is in the overnight. I think that model is dying, unfortunately.
But do you think that given that many of the, even in the smallest markets, the AM and FM radio stations are moving to streaming, they're making their network or their station available 24/7 whenever you want to hear it by putting up a streaming model, and as I watch that, I'm saying to myself, isn't that counterproductive to the radio station to give to the consumer the option that they don't have to listen to me live, they can listen to me when they want to listen to me. But maybe that's one of the changes that's taking place in terrestrial radio, is that they've already begun to understand that their lives are limited.
Yeah, I think we're seeing your theory play out, and I think that sometimes moving to streaming is almost, you know, other stations are doing it, so it's kind of, well, then we need to do it too, whether it's the right thing to do or not. And you know, streaming is one thing, but streaming also, you know, requires some sort of connectivity. It's not like, you know, I mean, you might be able to download it and do it later. It takes a little bit more sophistication to do that. I think if I'm the owner of a radio station, then I'm going to figure out a way that I can shoot video of the show that's being recorded right now. I'm going to shoot video of my hosts. I'm going to shoot video of the guests. I'm going to cut that up into little snippets on YouTube and Instagram. I'm going to tell story around that. I'm going to convert that not into streaming, but I'm going to put it out to a podcast, which makes it more mobile, can be consumed easier than it can be on like a stream, because it's based on an app and not, you know, a browser connection. So instead of, you know, investing in those things, I'm going to really focus on how I can build story around the content and how I can share that in different ways, so I'm not a one-trick pony. And then I'm going to make sure that my show hosts and so forth are truly experts in their field. They're not, you know, they really have a deep expertise in whatever that show is about. And maybe that's, you know, becomes a book for small business owners within that region. And so there's a variety of different things. I think the platform of just one channel, whether that's TV, even if it's podcast, you know, one channel, true thought leaders are not one trick ponies, and they need to diversify in order to be more helpful to their audience.
We're talking with Stephen Vestner. He's here with his new book, Profitable Podcasting. I just want to make sure our audience knew who, what an interesting guest is and who he is. Steve, what is your website again?
PredictiveROI.com.
Dan, back to you.
Yeah, I just thought maybe we should take a moment and just step back, because maybe there may be some people listening to this show who don't understand the difference between podcast and streaming. Could you take a moment and help the audience look at those two things? Because I'm not so sure that they should be used interchangeable with each other.
No, you're right. They shouldn't be, and they are two completely different, you know, distribution mechanisms, if you will, right? Completely different sort of platforms. The content could be the same, right? It could be like it's essentially an MP3 file, right, recorded of that show, And then if mm-hmm. you are going to do quote-unquote streaming, you upload that to the server. It gives you a URL or essentially kind of a website link, if you will. And then if you go to the website link, you're able to listen to it from the link. So what that requires, though, is it requires, you know, be able to use a browser when you're on a mobile phone or when you're on your smartphone. That's not, you know, too terribly difficult, but it requires a level of, you know, internet connectivity, which, you know, again, if we're using our smartphone, that's not too terribly bad. But it's not as easy as if, you know, I open up, you know, my podcast app, whether I'm using Google Play or Stitcher or, you know, Spotify or whatever, and I have a list of all of the shows, you know, for that particular podcast. I have a list of all of the shows, and I can download as many as that I want, and I can go on an airplane, not need Wi-Fi, and I can listen to all of them. It's sort of like binge consumption, that phenomenon that we see with, like, Netflix and, you know, Amazon Prime Video and so forth, is that people like to consume, you know, 5, 6, 7 episodes at one time, and it's not as smooth of an experience with streaming. You know, podcasts just make it smoother to be able to do that.
So the person that's contemplating using some form of enhanced content, where do you think they should start? Should they start with streaming or should they start with podcasts?
Well, of course I'm biased, right? Because, you know, I'm a big fan of podcasts, but I mm-hmm. think that, you know, if somebody was going to, let's say like they had, going back to your example of, or the question about, you know, a station, right? So, you know, like an AM or an FM station, and we've got, you know, a host and a guest in a physical station, then the first thing that I would do is I would install cameras within that studio so that we could record the actual conversation between host and guest. And we would be streaming that out to Facebook Live, recording it at the same time, and later that would go out to YouTube and Instagram as a story and so forth. I have somebody on our team who is a great visual storyteller who could cut that up into nuggets that were super helpful for people to watch later who liked video. And then I would also take that video file, strip out the audio of it, and make it a podcast episode. I would not do streaming. I would do podcasts instead of streaming because podcasts is just smoother for consumption. And then I would take those little audio snippets and I would put those out to Instagram and so forth. I mean, we have to recognize that people consume content, you know, differently. Some like videos, some like audio, some like both. And so by doing that, you cut up the content across multiple formats. And so then the consumption rate can go higher. But I would look at telling the entire story and not just one thin slice.
Okay, super. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. You've provided a lot of information for our guests to think about, and I'm going to throw it back to Don to say goodbye.
We've been talking with Stephen Westner. His book is Profitable Podcasting. And Steve, thank you for joining us. And your website, once again?
It's predictiveroi.com. And gentlemen, thank you very much again for the invitation. It was a pleasure to be with you. And I'm grateful to spend some time with you and your audience. And I hope that was helpful for them.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business.
In New York this week, 500 managers and bankers from across the fintech world met to discuss the rising use of online financial resource companies. It was the latest of a number of such conclaves across the country. What does it mean for small business leaders? Speaker after speaker droned on about the funds available to grow their small businesses. Other panels talked about the ease such companies are making the loan process. Finding the money to grow can be as short as an hour. Some speakers said the average was 3 days versus going to a more traditional banking resource, which could take up to 3 months. But as one speaker pointed out, small businesses can suffer in one way from the fintech revolution. The personal banking touch that puts the small business leader in physical proximity to the banker, that personal touch that can come in handy should growth plans not work out exactly as expected, is not there. There is an old saying, when you owe enough to the bank, you own the bank. Most banks won't let that happen, but having a personal relationship can ease some issues. Fintech bankers are about doing everything over the internet. For those times when the small business succeeds, this works great. But what happens if they don't? It's harder without that personal touch. Our next guest is Mike Provance, who is Chief Executive Officer of 3x3 Insights. He leads an organization with a team of industry and technology experts who are more than experts. They practice the use of an application of data to the business of beverage alcohol consumption. And that's one thing I'll drink to. So you're really focused in the alcohol industry. Mike, tell us about your company, yourself, and your website.
You bet. Thank you very much for having me. So 3x3 Insights is an analytics and engagement company, marketing engagement, customer engagement company focused on the independent segment of the essentially the beer, wine, and spirits industry, meaning we focus on all the independent small retailers who are going up against the Total Wines and the Costco's and all the big box stores that in some states are able to carry competing products. So our focus is helping the entire industry better understand how, why, when, where, and what the customers of these independent retailers purchase so that they can improve the relationship they have with those customers.
And your website?
Sorry, our website is 3x3insights.com, 3x3insights.com, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter the same way.
Well, I'm going to ask the first question and then turn it over to Dan. So in essence, do you analyze what people buy and how they buy it? And then pass that data back down to independent stores? Would that be, am I hearing that correctly?
Exactly. We capture the day's transactions at the retailers and then aggregate all that data across stores and across markets to understand the dynamics of how the individual customers purchase. We also then use that data to deliver it back to retailers to help them understand their businesses better and understand how their businesses fit into the industry and the market better and help them make product choices that, you know, maybe capture trends earlier than they would otherwise capture or unload product that they see is no longer succeeding in the market on a much more prompt basis. So we do that for the entire industry, but our, with a strong relationship with the independent retailers because they're competing in a market where technology is taking over, and frankly, are many of them are struggling to figure out how they bring technology in their stores to do a better job engaging the customers.
Dan, I'd just like to follow up with one more question. I've been always fascinated by it. For instance, in Pennsylvania, all the liquor is sold in state stores, and in New Jersey, the number of stores varies by municipality, and they're different. For instance, my drugstore sells liquor and has one of the few licenses. Are all of them facing major changes in the way we buy liquor or wines?
Absolutely. I think one of the things you're seeing is that the markets are changing. And as you've identified, every market is at least at a state level defined by the regulations of that state. So, you know, in some states, a person can hold only one license for a store. In other states, there's fewer limits on that. And in certain states, you know, for example, you mentioned Pennsylvania, where, you know, the spirit side of the business is sold through state stores, and then there's other private retailers of beer and wine. And so one of the things you're seeing is that those regulatory environments are actually changing to encourage or to shift towards more privatization of this, although the controlled states, of which I think there's 13, are somewhat still in kind of internal conflict over how quickly they get to that privatized state or semi-privatized state. But at the end of the day, it's a unpredictable shift that could benefit retailers, but also makes anytime you have chaos in a market, you have, or uncertainty in a market, you have a hard time for the people playing in that market to predict the future.
Well, Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you. This is a fascinating subject, but I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. I'm having the challenge of asking questions about from somebody myself who has an allergy to alcohol, so I can't drink beer or wine or hard liquor. But that's okay. I used to when I was younger and enjoyed it. Let me ask you a question, if I might. Is the market for wine and beer and hard liquor declining or growing?
Well, I think those are three separate markets with their own set of dynamics. I think overall, the shift is there's no clear trend one way or another, but you do see shifts across. Things like the larger brands competing with artisanal brands, competing with independent brewers, distillers, or vineyards. And I think you're seeing, and I think some of this people attribute to the rise of the millennial generation looking at more independent-based products as being valuable, that you're seeing an increase in the independent purveyors in those segments of the market. But overall, I'm not sure that we see any significant decline other than seasonal but more of a shift in who's selling and the kinds of products coming into the market.
In the beer segment, has the protest at the NFL affected consumption?
That is an excellent question that I don't have any good data for sitting here on the phone with you, but I would imagine that any of these suppliers of beer, wine, spirits, and you know, beer in particular with football, have other outlets for driving their marketing dollar and putting it to use. And so, one event like that, I think you know the sophisticated suppliers find ways around those problems and find other outlets for driving customers. I don't think the consumption at the games themselves is meaningful in the overall data and U.S. and global consumption of beer, but certainly the prominence of the brands and the brands that may be moving away from it for those reasons. But it's really hard to tell. That's a fairly complex set of analytics to put together.
What are the trends in terms of what's growing in popularity in that space, all the beer, alcohol, and wine in that space, and is there anything losing favor?
Those are great questions. I think, you know, that in broad brush strokes, you're seeing a big surge in in the brown spirits business, and particularly in the U.S. around bourbon. I think that despite the naming convention of bourbon being tied to Kentucky, there are a lot of new independent American whiskeys that are coming on board, and new brands coming through the bigger suppliers as well, trying to capitalize on the interest in small batch distributions. So I think you've got this kind of surge in that area that seems to be picking up speed, and we'll have to get into the data to see where it is in its cycle. But like all new products, they follow a product life cycle curve, and so you're seeing Tito's in the vodka category having done tremendously well, along with some other brands, but also starting to stabilize and maybe develop a more stable course of growth, and the whole segment continuing to benefit. And this is an industry where that adage of a rising sea lifts all boats. You do see a pickup in other brands when you see a pickup in a really strong pickup in a brand like Tito's. And while some brands in that competition lose, it does carry some others. And so, in particular, pulling up price points that may be below their price point while they knock others in the same price point out.
Does the growth of the economy impact consumption?
Well,
or lack of growth in the economy?
So one of the historic benefits of being in I don't come from this industry, although we have people on our team who come from generations of retailers in the industry and have spent tremendous time in it. I come out of the technology world, although I have been known to sample once or twice from the product. The nature of the industry is countercyclical, and that historically everyone has looked at it that way in terms of, when the economy is declining, there's an increase in consumption, and when the economy is rising, you see a shift in higher price brands and higher value product. So I think it's less of it's not one of those products that people stop buying when the economy drops or shift to spending in other areas when it rises. I think there is a shift in the price point and the types of labels they go after when the economy changes. And one of the nice things about what 3x3 Insights does is not tackle that question at a very broad level, but rather dig into the behaviors of the customers at a more segmented level. So understanding in a rising economy, the shift in the bourbon market may be to higher end brands, where the shift in a brandy or in another category may be toward larger sizes or smaller sizes or more frequent purchases. And it's really untangling not the broad level of growth or decline, but rather what's happening at a more microscopic level in the market, if you will.
Is your research showing any new trends that are developing?
We're just getting into a lot of the we've only been around now for a few months, so we're just getting into the heart of the data that we're looking at. But we are seeing that some of the brands that have been popular in the last couple of years are starting to show signs of slowing down, and others, like I said, you see these macro trends in the brown spirits, but you also see more micro trends within the product inside that market, and so we're seeing some changes, but nothing that I would say I have enough data to stake any sort of claims on.
Dan, could I jump in here with a question?
Go ahead.
Mike, how did you get into this business?
Right. So, as I said, I came out of the technology world along with a couple others here, and my background is in working with big data and helping industries that are as slower to adopt technology than others are get a leap forward in the use of technology to build businesses. But I was able to come together with a group who had cut their teeth initially on understanding the consumer from the consumer's point of view in capturing receipts and offering rebates and building a business around that kind of customer engagement. But finding that there's a much bigger opportunity if we could help the whole industry restructure the way it uses data and the kind of data that it could capture. And so we ended up, you know, focusing our business on what I see as a really core problem of independent retailers and small retailers. You know, with the impact of Amazon and companies like that coming into the market and the growth, the rapid growth in online sales of alcohol, the independent brick-and-mortar retailer should be a little bit nervous about how they're growing their business and how they're kind of shoring up their defenses to keep their customers coming in the door and buying from them. And that's what we sought to help out because, as I mentioned before, our three by three Insights, our team, some of our team come from families that have been doing this for years and understand the industry inside and out.
But Mike, I live in New Jersey, and we deal with something called the ABC, the Alcohol and Beverage Control Commission, here in the state. And for us here in New Jersey, if you own a liquor store, it's like a license to mint money. They never go on sale. They're always whether they're independent or not, the licenses are worth a lot of money. How do you help a company like a business like that? That basically all they have to do is sit back and wait for the customers to come in.
That's a great question. In fact, part of our footprint is in New Jersey, so we know there's interest in our product at 3x3 from that state. And I think the answer lies in, you know, there's a lot of different reasons to work with us, but one of them is to run your business more profitably. And while a license in states like New Jersey may give people kind of a corner on certain parts of the market, it still doesn't ensure that the business is run in a way that the profits increase. And let me give you an example of that. If you have a retailer that doesn't have a lot of data flowing in from their store and they simply are in the habit of running the business like they have for the last 20 years, they're working off their guts and what their neighbors are doing in terms of changes in interest in buying product. And so they could be delayed by as much as 3, 6, 9 months in switching over to a new brand that's coming out, or seeing a brand that they carry and that they've stocked up heavily on suddenly going into a state of decline. And it creates this system effect where, you know, you end up overstocked in product you can't move, and suddenly your inventory costs are climbing and your profit margins are getting squeezed. And we're talking about retailers that operate on, you know, net profit margins that are below 5%. So a point here and there really, really does matter to how healthy they are.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here with your Recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. So you formed your business and you used an LLC. Do you really know what you want to do and how to get there? Not without a business plan. An old Chinese saying, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there. So here is your Recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. There are a lot of great books on building business plans. I suggest you start simple. As your business grows, you can become more elaborate. I recommend The Business Plan for Dummies, available in local bookstores or at Amazon. If you know nothing about business plans, then a complicated plan may well scare you away from doing one at all. You used to be able to do things by the seat of your pants, but no more. Don't be a dummy. Get a book, and you'll be smarter for it. This has been your Recalculating.biz Small Business Tip of the Day. I'm Dan Perkins.
Well, you know, the other question I have is small businesses, whatever the industry, the minute they hear the word big data, get scared. They feel that the big companies have advantages and little companies don't, because they don't have the expertise to examine big data the way it should. Am I right in assuming that what you're doing is taking that role over for small businesses, in this case the liquor, and that people in other industries should look for people like yourself?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that the small players in any of these industries feel a ton of pressure around how to use data, how to use technology. And, you know, as I mentioned, I come out of the technology industry and have worked across plenty of industries where you have many, many small ones trying to determine what to do. And, you know, I think one of the things that we try to do at 3x3 is not just give them data, because, you know, as you said, data can be a little bit of a difficulty surmounting it and knowing what to do with it. We spend our time making it actionable, making it useful, making it meaningful to them, and we do that both through reducing that data down to insights, down to information that they can actually make decisions from, like how well their products are moving, which product, you know, if they're in a market with, you know, a very diverse population, being able to look at other markets with similar population characteristics and say, well, what products are moving in these markets? Maybe I should be carrying those. And being able to get a more real-time or more current picture of how things are moving in the market so they can react more quickly. So that's where we help out. You know, we provide the data to the retailers in exchange for them sharing their data with us, and then we layer on that education that helps them make it useful, and then ultimately also building and delivering tools that let them better target their customers through email marketing, through social media marketing, through text marketing, anything that makes their customers more loyal, more comfortable, more close with the stores, and helping them grow their customer base. Our vision of this business is not a data company per se, but really creating an ecosystem of on and off premise small retailers that can move customers that want to be buying beverage alcohol, you know, beer, wine, and spirits, back and forth through these locations and buying the products they want to be buying, and not, you know, having to settle when they go in a place that doesn't have exactly what they're interested in buying. And that comes from better understanding who buys what in the market and being able to target that.
So you're saying are you suggesting that your customer is not the big box store? It's the independent guy at the corner.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that probably gets overlooked with the level of marketing that comes out of the big box end of the industry is that, you know, the 50 to 60% nationally of locations to buy alcohol from are independent retailers, either in the, and I'm speaking specifically off premise. The numbers are higher when you get into the restaurant and bar side of things. But in the liquor stores nationally, it's about 50 to 60%. And what's unusual is that if you only look at the East Coast from, say, Maine down through Florida and over to Texas, which I realize isn't quite East Coast, that whole market represents the bulk of those independent retailers. That as you go west, the big box stores take over. But this area that's on the East Coast, when you talk to suppliers and producers of alcohol, they really talk about this being a dark part of the market, that they just can't get data from it because it's so hard to collect data from the small retailers. So we've dedicated our company and our efforts to essentially shedding light on that dark part of the market.
So how do you get those independents to open up their books and tell you what's going on?
Well, first of all, we're not asking them to open up their books. We have no interest in how much money they're making and what their revenue and their profits are. We're interested in what their customers are buying. And so we, mm-hmm. we work with them, and we have a number of different mechanisms with data technology and hardware and software technology to collect data that lets us help them see the sales data, the actual baskets that are flowing through their store. And so imagine, you know, that when you go to the store to purchase maybe some wine and some beer and a bottle of rum, that retailer will do that transaction with you and half an hour later have forgotten who you were and what you bought. And we want to be able to help them see those baskets over time, accumulate data about what's in the basket, how big the baskets are, how frequently certain things are purchased together. You know, there's kind of an urban myth / piece of research about consumers that talks about a study P&G did that looked at store purchases and found that beer and diapers were purchased collect together the most frequently in the stores. And so they were able to adjust by putting the two products closer together to make it easier on the purchasers, which turned out to be men showing up to run an errand, pick up the diapers, and bring beer home more effectively. Well, we don't have the diapers at the liquor store, but we do have different products that often travel together in baskets and home to these consumers, and we're helping the retailers understand that better. And kind of, you know, that essentially is the mission of 3x3 Insights, is what's happening three feet from the shelf, or 3 feet from the bar, or 3 feet from the waiter at the restaurant when people decide to order beer, wine, or spirits.
When you go into Don and I are from New Jersey, and I live in Florida now, and the old corner liquor store where they sold it by the bottle and it was stand up on a shelf and wasn't necessarily the most inviting place to go, many of them been replaced by these very sophisticated wine markets that sell wine and beer and alcohol and cheese and breads and all kinds of stuff. That they're dramatically changing the face of what the marketplace is from when I first started drinking many, many years ago. Do you see that happening in other parts of the country too?
Absolutely. And we're based in New York City, and so I can tell you that, you know, there's roughly 1,200 independent liquor retailers in New Jersey, and we have some that look exactly like what you just described, and we have others that look like those old-fashioned liquor stores where you know, it's local community and people go in to buy what they want to buy, and they don't worry about how the place looks. And you know what? It does the job it needs to do, and the person running it is happy with that business, but the one common thread to all of them is they want to figure out how to do it better. We're learning how to work in all these different environments effectively and deliver data that's useful.
Dan, that's got to be the last question, unfortunately.
Okay.
Mike, tell us your website again and how people can reach you.
Yeah, absolutely. So 3x3 Insights, and it's 3x3, it's 3x3insights.com. And like I said, you can use the same thing to find us on Facebook and Twitter as well.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been illuminating, and a link to your website will be on recalculating.biz tonight.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the time.
And Don, for those of our audience who didn't hear all the interview or missed some of the other interviews of the program today, they can go to recalculating.biz and they can look at this show and past shows to keep themselves current about what's going on in small business.
Great point, Dan. Great point.
Dan Perkins here for Songs and Stories for Soldiers with your veterans tip of the day. Did you know that the suicide rate for women vets is 12 times that of their sisters in civilian life? Did you know that 1 in 4 women vets feel uncomfortable about talking to people about their mental health issues? Did you know almost 600,000 women vets in America are suffering from PTSD? It's time to help. It's time for all of us to encourage our sisters, mothers, and wives to get help by contacting their local VA hospital, clinic, or community-based health care center. So if you know a woman vet that is suffering, go to va.gov and find their nearest VA facility. This has been Dan Perkins of Songs and Stories for Soldiers.us with your veterans' tip of the day.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.